great, isn't it? You won't understand it first time through, but if you muddle along three times, you might make sense. That's good stuff. We're going to look at three so that's in 2 Corinthians in this session. Three little, what the lawyers would call causal clauses, that introduced us to the paradox of divine power. First one's in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But this happened so that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. Second one's in chapter 4, verse 7, the second so that of divine power. But we have this treasure in jars of clay in order to... It's not quite a so that, but it's it will have to do as a so that. It's pretty much a so that. We have this power in this. We have this treasure in jars of clay in order to show, in order that it might be seen that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. And the third so that is in chapter 12, verse 9. But God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. Now here is the paradox of divine power. Do you need more paper? Anyone here need more paper? Run out of paper after last time? Sorry, no hand. I am no handout. William, I'm afraid. No handouts. Very inadequate. Here is the paradox, and it might be helpful for you to write it down. When God works in his mighty power, when God works in his mighty power, he deliberately acts to ensure that the human vessels through whom he works appear weak, frail and inadequate. When God works in his mighty power, he deliberately acts to ensure that the human vessels through whom he works appear weak, frail and inadequate. And he does this, and he does this to ensure that it is self-evidently his power that has achieved the result. You don't have to write all of that down, but so when God works in his mighty power, he deliberately acts to, he did to make sure that the human vessels through whom he works appear weak, frail and inadequate, and he does it to make sure that it's evident his power comes from him alone. Now you can see the deliberate intent in chapter 4 verse 7, and we're going to have these three passages right at the fore. Chapter 4 verse 7, we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. And you can see it in did you want me to read chapter 4, verse 7 again? We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the all-surpassing power comes from God and not from us. And then you can see it again in chapter 12, verse 9a. Where God says, my grace is sufficient for you, for power, my power, is made perfect in weakness. And you can see the principle in chapter 12, verse 9b. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. And you can see the paradox of divine power at the end of verse 10. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Here's the paradox again, just in case you missed it first time through. God's mighty power is demonstrated and experienced in the context of human weakness, frailty, and inadequacy. When God works in power, he deliberately acts to ensure that the human vessel through whom he works appears weak and inadequate. Now, four qualifying statements, and don't worry, most of the meat is in this first bit, so you should be able to pick up the four qualifying statements. A. Paul is not saying that he deliberately goes out of his way to court weakness. He doesn't court weakness like some kind of religious masochistic martyr. Just look at chapter 12, verse 7. To keep me from being conceited, because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given to me a thorn in my flesh. Where does the thorn come from? Somebody? Kevin, can you tell me? 12:7. To keep me from becoming conceited, because of the surpassingly great revelations, there was given to me a thorn. Where does the thorn come from?
God.
So Paul is not saying he deliberately goes out of his way to court weakness. No, weakness is given to him. Paul is not saying that suffering and weakness is in and of itself good. Chapter 12, verse 7. There was given to me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger from Satan. Where does the thorn come from, Kevin? Satan. Yeah, that's right. So he doesn't go out, it's given by God, and yet it's a messenger from Satan. So he's not saying that the weakness and the inadequacy and the thorn is in and of itself good. No, it's a messenger of Satan. He doesn't court weakness. No, he's given the thorn. Nor is he saying that he glories in suffering itself, as if he'd entered into a higher sort of trance-like state of exuberance and just says, suffering, come on, hit me, like some kind of maniacal something or other, grinning maniacally. Is that the right adverb? Can you grin maniacally? You don't know, so the answer is yes. If nobody knows, then just state it with more authority. He doesn't just kind of say, hit me with more suffering. No, he pleads three times to have it taken away. So he doesn't sort of exult in suffering in that way. Nor does he ever say there is an automatic fourth qualifying statement. Nor does he ever say there is an automatic connection between suffering and God's power, such that if somebody is suffering and weak, they must therefore be experiencing the power of God. Rather, here is the principle: God is in charge of all suffering and hardship, and he deliberately acts to ensure that the person in whom he is working appears weak. Well, just say any of that again. There's a certain amount of passing around of bits of paper and scrabbling after remarks. Anybody want me to say any of that again? From number three. You only counted three? The principle is that God deliberately acts and so on. A, he's not deliberately going out of his way to court suffering. The thorn was given by God. He's not saying suffering and weakness is in and of itself good. The thorn is a messenger from Satan. He's not saying that he glories in suffering, like the thing I said, the adverb, which probably isn't one. He doesn't sort of grin maniacally at suffering. No, he suffers. D, he's not saying there is an automatic connection between suffering and God's power. Now, this paradox that God deliberately acts in this way should not surprise us. It is, after all, what all of us should have learned at key stage one, the end of primary school. Or is it the beginning of primary school, Meg? It's the beginning of primary school. We should have learned this lesson. It is the first lesson of the Christian faith. For the paradox of divine power is seen most clearly where? Where? At the cross. And in every one of these three so that's, the so that comes in the context of an explanation of the power of God working through the death of Jesus. 13 verse 4. For, to be sure, Christ was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by God's power. Likewise, we are weak in him, yet by God's power we will live to serve you. So as you look at Jesus hanging on the cross, what do you see? Humanly speaking, what do you see? What is the Aristophanes in John Stott's Cross of Christ? The little page boy in the school just outside. Sorry?
Donkey.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Richard. Thank you very much. It is a donkey. You're quite right, yeah. There's a picture, isn't there, of a cross with a donkey on it and a little thing underneath. Aristophanes worships his god. What does the cross... What is the cross? It's a picture of utter weakness. What is happening on the cross... God is working in absolute power. Absolute power. Because he is transferring my guilt onto Christ, Christ's righteousness onto me, and therefore he is defeating condemnation and death. It is the point of God's supreme power. But of course, in Corinth, the false teachers who have infiltrated the church have missed this. They teach a different Jesus. They don't teach the crucified Christ. They teach a different spirit and a different gospel, as we were hearing about just now. And it appears that they have moved away from the crucified Christ and therefore have a picture of ministry that doesn't have the cross right at its heart. So... the super apostles, if you turn to chapter 11, verse 5, I'm actually staying in a super apostles' room this weekend, so I'm a little bit shy about this. If you've seen my room, I mean, it should have super apostle written above it. It's the sort of room they would have put a super apostle in. He calls them super apostles, doesn't he, in 11, verse 5. Don't think I'm in the least inferior to these super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker. It appears that the super apostles were excellent speakers, were brilliant orators, were powerful figures. Look at verse 10 of chapter 10. His letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he's unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing. Humanly speaking, Paul appears weak. The super apostles, it would seem, know no setbacks, no change of plans. They're powerful speakers who move from one glorious ministry success to the next. And Paul says, actually, no, go back to key stage one. Look at the foundation principle of the Christian message. What do we see when God works in power? We see a picture of human weakness as God works in his divine power. And Christian ministry, the so that's tell us, will always reflect that picture of human weakness as the divine power of God is shown. So says Paul, when God is genuinely at work, he deliberately works to ensure that his human agents appear weak. Just go back to 13:4, because it's clearly stated there, isn't it? To be sure, Christ was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by God's power. Likewise, we are weak in him. In other words, when Paul is in Christ, as he proclaims the message of the crucifixion, he appears weak. Yet by God's power, he lives to serve the Corinthians. There's the paradox. Second point, paradox of a divine power. Secondly, the appearance of divine power. And I want us to look at the two passages, chapter 4 and chapter 11, through to chapter 12, to see what, therefore, does divine power actually look like? And the answer is in chapter 4, verse 7. What does divine power look like, humanly speaking? Chapter 4, verse 7. Any takers? What does divine power look like? What item does divine power look like? A jar of clay. Thank you, Caroline. Yeah. Now, the trouble with that is that jars of clay pots, are now rather highly desirable consumer items. So the Evanses, who've just moved into their new house, will no doubt have nipped down to Homebase or the Chelsea Gardener even, and purchased a clay pot, a nice, smart sort of Charlie Dimmock, Alan Titmarsh sort of home accessory to put their plants in. But in the first century, the clay jar was the thing in which you put your light that you took up to your room, your candle. And Paul is saying we have the light-giving, powerful gospel of Jesus in a clay jar, an expendable two-a-penny item, like our plastic cups, like one of these, actually, which if you're of a nervous disposition as I am, you will have chewed the top of before you threw it away. And then you just throw it away. Frail, expendable. So chapter 4, verse 7, God, that's my visual aid, by the way, for the weekend. If you're just interested, you want to know, yeah, we have them. That was a visual aid. It wasn't a polystyrene cup, but it was near enough. Sorry you couldn't see it on tape. I mean, you missed out. You should have been here. You missed it. See verse 7? We have this treasure, the glorious treasure of the gospel that brings life, that opens the gate of heaven, that ushers people into eternity, the powerful and glorious work, the ministry of the Spirit, that brings people into the family of God. Where do we have it? We have it in a polystyrene cup, an expendable item. And then he uses four pairs of words in verses 8 and 9 to explain what this expendable item, what the experience of the authentic gospel minister looks like as the paradox of divine power works itself out in the Read, Mark, Learn leader. We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. Pair number one. Hard pressed? Hard pressed is the kind of squashed in on every side. And we have a very interesting phrase in our family, which sometimes the girls ask us, how big is your box at the moment? And what is meant by that is, you know, if you're really, really kind of relaxed and laid back, you're in a big room and life is easy. And if you're kind of, you know, mildly 50% stressed out, then you're in a smaller room. And then if it's really life is 75%, you're in the cupboard under the stairs. And then if, you know, really you're at the end of your tether, you're in a matchbox. Not that any of us actually live in matchboxes or under the stairs or anything like that, but it's a picture of how hard pressed are you? Paul says we are hard pressed on every side. That the clay pot experience of a clay pot minister leading RML will be one of pressure, but not crushed. You see, like the James Bond movie, the sides of the walls move in, but they never actually crush Paul. For God is at work in him, in power, enabling him in his clay pot experience to carry on. Pair number two, verse eight, perplexed, at a loss. It's what the disciples were in the upper room when Jesus said he was going to go. Perplexed, at a loss. But not literally totally at a loss. Not utterly at a loss. So the normal experience of the authentic and genuine Christian worker, the clay pot experience of a cross-shaped ministry, will be looking at the diary on Sunday night and seeing what's going on that week and saying to oneself, I am at a loss to know how I'm going to do this. I mean, I've got the study to prepare, I've got the personal work to do, my co-leader seems to be going off the rails. I mean, I'm just at a loss to know how I'm going to... Stop nodding about your co-leader. That was meant as a sort of aside. I'm just at a loss. How am I going to do it? The normal experience of a person planting a church in Mayfair will be the Ethiopians are sitting in. We have nowhere to meet. What are we going to do? But not totally at a loss. Persecuted, verse 9. Well, some of you will know that in your own family. I mean, we won't know it quite, perhaps, as some other cultures, but you may face it at work. After the carol service, I got two emails from different workers who explained the persecution that they were facing as a result of having preached the gospel. But not forsaken. Do you see verse 9? Not abandoned. Not forsaken by God. And then the end of verse 9 is just a wonderful word. It's an epic. It's from the boxing ring. Knocked out. Or rather, knocked down, but not knocked out. It's from the field of combat. You know, dealt a deathly blow, but not dead. And some of you will have heard me say this before. I keep in my study a picture of, at home, a picture of somebody handed me of the bomb and St. Helens after the bomb. I think the bombs set back St. Helen's ministry probably by about a decade. I don't think anybody, people are shocked when I say that, but when I go and explain just how and in which different ways the bomb set back the ministry at St. Helen's, I think a decade is probably fair. And you look at the utter devastation and you think of the people who worked there picking through, you know, glass this deep all across the Commercial Union Square. And knocked down is it, isn't it? But not destroyed. And I want you to note in verse 8 the on every side, which is literally in everything. So that it's not just as Paul gets up to lead his Read, Mark, Learn study, or to give a talk, or to lead the Christianity Explored group, that he's hard-pressed, crushed, perplexed, and persecuted. Rather, it is in every aspect of the work of proclaiming Christ. So let's go then, shall we, to Paul's explanation of his experience in chapter 11, in the middle of what's called the fool's speech, and let's read what it actually felt like and look at the in everything that Paul experienced. And we'll pick it up at verse 23. Are these false apostles, these super apostles, are they servants of Christ? Chapter 11, verse 23. I'm out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. Now look, isn't it interesting how Paul describes an authentic servant of Christ in verse 23? I am more. I have worked much harder. Isn't that extraordinary? The first phrase, are they servants of Christ? I am more. I've worked much harder. Isn't that an extraordinary first thing to say? What does slaving, serving Christ look like? Hard work. I think it's very striking, isn't it? I've worked much harder. I've been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I take it that means that he was actually there, not in a boat, but bobbing about, like thingamajig in the Titanic, you know, except not quite so cold, in the Mediterranean. Verse 26, been constantly on the move, nowhere to live, have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger from the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, in danger from false brothers. There it is again. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst. I have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I don't feel weak? You know, I am concerned for the individual in my Read, Learn group. And when I sense that they are weak, I feel it. Who is led into sin? I see somebody going off the rails and I inwardly burn. So as Paul seeks to book his flight at the travel agent and plans his itinerary, he experiences the paradox of divine power, the clay pot experience. As Paul tries to start a new ministry in Mayfair, he experiences the clay pot experience. As Paul attempts to keep a Read, Mark, Learn group afloat, or to organise a social, or to to follow up an individual in Christianity Explores, he experiences the clay pot ministry. As he deals with a building, or with the administration, or as he seeks to set up an evening or something like that, he experiences it. As he relates to his team of co-workers, he experiences it. His experience of ministry is that of a clay pot. What's his point? God works in his mighty power, and as he does it, he deliberately acts to ensure that the human vessel through whom he works appears weak and frail, so that the glory is self-evidently his. Now, the vessel may not appear weak and frail to everybody else, but the vessel appears weak and frail to itself, and sometimes to everybody else, for they say of Paul, chapter 10, in person he is unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing. Now, I think it's very easy to look over one's shoulder at ministry and at other people in ministry and to think that they are omnicompetent Christian superheroes who experience no such thing. I think it's maybe easy, I don't know, to look at the staff team. Sometimes I look at others on the staff team and I think they are omnicompetent Christian superheroes. But I know, because I know the staff team, that most of them have experienced many of them have experienced some sort of intense personal tragedy at one stage or another while they've been with us. Just about all of them have experienced some form of personal weakness, sickness, feelings of inadequacy, and so on. Personally, I don't think I'd ever really wept in despair through pressure until I came into Christian ministry. And at St. Helens, it's something that has happened reasonably frequently. I don't mean to be melodramatic in that. I just want us to be clear. The trouble with the British stiff upper lip is that we all have this kind of charge of the light brigade view of ministry. Or is it Waterloo? I always get it wrong. Is it Waterloo? My goodness, sir, I believe you've lost your leg. Oh, my goodness, so I have. And then and then he rode on. He rode on, the idiot. But you see, Paul, he just doesn't do that. We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardship we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life itself. Indeed, in our hearts, we felt the sentence of death. Yet, chapter 4, verse 12, death is at work in us, but life in you. So the appearance of authentic Christian ministry, I think this is enormously encouraging. There was this is probably unfair, but none of you will know him, so I shall say it. There was a real pain in the neck worked alongside us in Bromley in another church. And we used to have an evangelical fraternal where we would all turn up to. And this guy just had the wrong view of ministry. And the cross didn't really play a part. And so his ministry marched from one triumphant success to another. And when we'd meet, you know, I'd say, well, how are you getting on? He'd say, oh, it's fantastic. And you think, oh, great, you know, I'm so encouraged. You know, we've just been speaking to crowds of thousands in Malaysia, and then we flew off to somewhere else, and then we flew off and the church is growing and it's booming and everybody's responding and so on and so forth. And, you know, that was just not my experience. And coming to Paul and authentic Christian ministry, cross-shaped Christian ministry, divine power, evident in human weakness, clothed in human weakness. Well, it's such a relief, isn't it? It was to me. Now, the final two points come under one heading, are the impact of divine power. And I think this principle of divine power should impact us in two areas. First, which we've already begun to touch on, what do we boast about? Chapter 11, verse 21. Let's go back to the fool's speech. This is what's called the fool's speech in Corinthians, where Paul, 2 Corinthians, where Paul starts to speak as a fool. And I think he has in mind a fool who teaches a different Jesus. And so he begins to speak as the super apostles might speak. And I want you to notice the change that happens after about three verses. Verse 16. Let no one take me for a fool, but if you do, then receive me just as you would a fool, so that I may do a little boasting. In this self-confident boasting, I'm not talking as the Lord would, the crucified Christ, but as a fool. Since many are boasting in the way the world does, brackets, the super apostolic false teachers who are in the smartest room in whatever this house is we're in at the moment, I too will boast like they do. You gladly put up with fools, since you're so wise. In fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you or exploits you or takes advantage of you, pushes himself forward or slaps you in the face, as the false teachers do. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. Now here's his boast. What anyone else dares to boast about, I am speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast about. Now, can you imagine Paul's supporters? They've been sitting in this church in 2 Corinthians, in Corinth, and the super apostles have come with their amazing CVs. This is my kind of pedigree. And Paul now says, I'm about to boast. And you can imagine his supporters, yes, at last. Now Paul is going to tell us what a fantastic minister he is. We will hear of the venues he's spoken at, the conferences he's set up, the churches he's planted, the speaking gifts, the numbers of people who've gone into full-time ministry, the numbers of people on follow-up courses, the funds he's raised. Well, verse 22, are they Hebrews? So am I. So far, so good. Are they Israelites? So am I. Excellent. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I. Yes, he's about to get into it. Are they servants of Christ? This is it. I am more. I've worked much harder. I've been in prison more frequently. I've been flogged more severely. I've been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I've received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. Now do you see the Paul will not boast about his kind of dynamic success. He won't do it. And in verse 23, look at verse 30. If I will boast, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show what? My weakness. And what does he boast of in verse 31? The God and Father of our Lord Jesus, who is to be praised forever, knows that I'm not lying. In Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me, and I ran away. That's what he's saying in verse 33, isn't it? I ran away. I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and legged it. You see, Corinthians, you may listen to these false teachers who move from one position of strength to another, who charge high fees, who have glossy brochures, who never fail. But if you've not experienced abject failure from a human point of view, and if they haven't suffered, and if they don't feel weak and helpless, I wonder if they're servants of Christ at all. Certainly, if they are boasting in the kind of things that the false teachers are boasting in, then they are preaching a different Jesus, a different spirit, and a different gospel. For it is not the Jesus who was crucified in weakness. And so the false teachers have failed at key stage one of the Christian faith. So says Paul, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness. Now here's my question. Would we have gone to a church led by the Apostle Paul? Would we have gone to a church led by the Apostle Paul? He preaches the cross, but he is battered and bruised, like Christ, and he doesn't appear very impressive. Would you have gone to his church? I think it's very easy for us to give the impression in good old St. Helens, by the way we speak and behave, unless we're careful, it's easy to give the impression that something has to appear exciting and dynamic, slick, in order for it to be a place where God is at work. And it seems, I don't think it's too strong, you will pick me up on this, but I want to make the point reasonably forcefully. I think it seems that the opposite is the case. Not that we should work for drab, dull, undynamic, and the opposite to slick, an operation. But it does seem that when God is at work, he will set up setbacks and hardship and difficulty in order to be sure that the glory is seen to be entirely his, and we are on our knees asking him to work in power. I picked up a magazine the other day reporting on some Christian initiative or other, full of pictures of the leader, of the staff team, of the figures, of the success rates, of the maps of the world to show where it was advancing, without a mention of weakness. There were pictures of glamorous people, glamorous leaders, glamorous ministry. And the suggestion was almost, you know, if you join this movement, there will be guaranteed growth. Paul, chapter 11, verse 30. If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. Chapter 9, second half, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness. So let's have no charge of the Light Brigade British godlessness at St. Helens. Let's be honest. I mean, we don't have to tell everybody about our weaknesses. Let's not spend the whole of the rest of the weekend pouring our guts out over the table to everybody. Sorry, I've done a little bit of it here, but I wanted you to be clear that there are no super apostles at St. Helens. At least I hope they're not. And I think that's what shocked me so much when I came into Christian ministry, because having spent 10 years working in camps, summer holiday camps, which were wonderful, where I learned a huge amount, I don't think I'd really seen the harsh reality, if you like, of genuine Christian ministry. I thought Christian ministry was about, you know, blue-eyed sort of sports heroes charging around in shorts and giving talks occasionally. And heroines. So first, what do we boast in? Secondly, what are we content with? For the paradox of divine power will impact our contentment in ministry. It will help us, if we understand the paradox of divine power, to be content as we experience the clay pot syndrome. We will learn to have a right understanding, you see, of what it feels like to be in Christian ministry. And that is what we see with Paul in verses 7, 8, 9 and 10 of chapter 12. See, I think it's very easy to look over our shoulders and think, oh, if only I moved, then Christian living, Christian ministry would be easy. I mean, I used to do that in Bromley. I used to look at these big London churches and I used to think to myself, gosh, it must be a doddle up there with all those staff and you can just concentrate on your area of ministry. And it must be a cinch. And then now I'm at St. Helens. I look at, do you remember Richard Coombs? I look at Richard Coombs, you know, ensconced there in Burford amid the soft beige hue of the Cotswold stone. And I think, oh, it must be a doddle out there. Who knows? Nobody lives there apart from anything else except a few cows. Not even allowed to go and visit them. In case you pass the foot and mouth around, it must be a cinch. And I think it's very easy, you see, as we experience the harshness, the reality of the divine paradox, of the cross, of cross-shaped ministry, to be looking over, oh, if only I went and led something else other than Read, Mark, Learn, or if I moved somewhere else other than London. If I find some nice other ministry, I could serve God there, and it would all be straightforward and easy. But the paradox of divine power tells me that wherever I am, if God's power is at work, ministry, it will appear clay pot-like to me and to others as they look at me. All Christian ministry is like that, because all Christian ministry, if it's Christian, has the cross at its heart. And so says Paul, to keep me from being conceited, verse 7 of chapter 12, because of these surpassing great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insults, in hardship, in persecution, in difficulties, for when I am weak, then I am strong. Now, Paul does not deliberately go out of his way to court suffering. Paul does not say that suffering is in and of itself good. He does not glory in suffering like some kind of maniacal, trance-like idiot. And he is not saying there's an automatic connection between suffering and God's power. But once you understand the divine paradox of God's power, then you will learn contentment. As we close, let me tell you, some of the finest Christian workers I know suffer from severe depression. At least 2 or 3 of them suffer from really bad depression. Numbers have personal tragedies in their family and struggle with the apparent lack of qualifications that they have and just the reality of their experience. But they have learned the message of the cross. So they preach Jesus Christ and him crucified. And you can see the fruit of God working in power, bringing life. all over the world. I think we'll close there. Shall we pray? And then we'll go and have some lunch. We have this treasure in jars of clay. He was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by God's power. Our Father God, we praise you for your power at work. In our church family, we give you thanks, Lord, for individuals who've come to know you, for members of our groups who've grown, for friends, as we just look around this room, who we've seen develop and grow in Christian living. And we praise you for your power at work. Lord, please, would you keep us on our knees, dependent entirely on you. Pray that you would teach us to boast in weakness and not in power. For your name's sake. Amen.